Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead in just a bit, Philly is on a mission to plant more trees, part of a plan to make urban living a healthier experience. But first, we talk about in-state college tuition. When my children were considering higher education not so very long ago, I told them, if you go to a state school, your father and I will be able to do more for you. As taxpayers, we help to support the system, and the reward is a sizable break on tuition, or at least that's the idea. Is this model starting to break down? State funding for higher education has been dropping across much of the country, and the fallout is particularly dramatic in Pennsylvania. A report in the Philadelphia Inquirer has found that the state's tax-supported networks of four-year colleges are plagued by high costs, a dramatic drop in the number of Pennsylvania students attending, and not only that, but the average debt for a student who attended a public college in Pennsylvania in 2018 was just over $37,000, nearly $8,000 higher than the national average. So, what are prospective students and their families to think? We are joined by Bob Fernandez, who reported on this for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome to Radio Times, Bob.
Thanks, Mary.
And Kate Shaw is Executive Director of Research for Action, a nonprofit educational research organization. Welcome back, Kate.
Thanks, Mary.
Bob Fernandez, you write that Pennsylvania's funding of its public colleges ranks among the nation's lowest, and that the network of four-year colleges has dealt with years of underinvestment. Why is the money to these institutions shrinking?
Absolutely. I call it the Rust Belt of higher education or public higher education because it has almost all the same economic characteristics of what we know as the Rust Belt from the 80s and the 90s, which is, you know, after World War II, corporations failed to invest in their factories. The factories became inefficient. There was excess capacity. And the cost of the products were high. And that's almost exactly what's happening in Pennsylvania in the public college system now. You have probably two decades at least of underinvestment into the colleges. Every time there's a recession, the state legislature will pull back the funding, but then never restore it after the recession in the boom times, which is exactly what happened in the 2008 recession, which was particularly hard on the public colleges. And there just doesn't seem to be a will to restore that funding in the legislature. I think, you know, Pennsylvania is like a little America where you have a large land area, you have Democrats and Republicans, and the Republican members do not want higher taxes that come with better college funding. So the kids are getting hurt.
We're going to get to the political divide in just a bit. But first of all, Kate, when funding is cut at a college or university, which services tend to go first?
That's a good question. Oftentimes what goes first are student services. You know, colleges and universities try to retain funding for their core service, which is education. But the unfortunate fact is that for many of our students in our public institutions, they're the first in their family to go to college. They're not familiar necessarily with how to navigate college. They have other stressors on them. They might be working. They might have children. And so for those students, it's particularly important to receive supports and services to sort of ensure that they stay on track and help them through college. And as state funding gets cut, tuition rises, as Bob pointed out. But for the other costs that don't get covered by tuition, you will see that some institutions are doing away with services. And something just happened for the Harrisburg Area Community College where counseling services, I think, were removed from the campus.
So the average debt for a student who attended a public college in Pennsylvania last year, just over $37,000. Kate, do you see a direct link between underfunding and the ballooning of student debt then?
Sure, because it's really a zero-sum game. If it costs $30,000 to educate a student and the percentage of that money that's coming from the state goes down, higher ed institutions have to raise tuition to cover that. And that's exactly what's happening. And so when you see that the state university system, which is the least expensive four-year degree in the state, you see those student loan burdens, you know, burgeoning, that's a really big red flag for the state because all those tuition or those loan repayments mean that there's going to be less purchasing power from all those students. And so in the long run, it hurts our economy because it keeps the tax base lower than what we might like to see.
Bob, you profile, I believe I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Rob Pignatello? Or Pignatello?
Sounds good.
Okay. The president of Lock Haven University. He literally slings a guitar on his back to sing and to raise money to help students pay their way. Set the scene for us. This is the president of Lock Haven University.
Right, the president of Lock Haven University. So when you write a big story like this, you like to try to personalize it and bring some drama to it. As I was doing the research, the numbers were just sort of startling and stunning and scary, where you have all these branch campuses that are taxpayer-supported around the state, the Penn State campuses and the Pasche schools, enrollments down 20, 30, 40, even 50% over the decade. And, I think many times you sort of go and you profile a student who's getting a lot of debt or something like that. But I was going through the Facebook pages of these colleges, and I saw that he had scheduled this fundraiser at the Broken Axe Brew Pub and said, come and help me raise money for the students. This is for freshmen and sophomores who might not have enough money to get by, and I'll play a guitar. And I thought, wow, that's a president, university president's really dealing with the problem and putting himself out there. And
boots
so
on
I
the
want,
ground.
Yeah, boots on the ground. And so I called him up and said, hey, I'd like to go to his little concert. And that's what I did. And I walked in, and he was, it was this Broken Axe Brew Pub. It was by the train tracks in this kind of rundown part of Lock Haven. I walked there from the hotel, and he's up there in front of the window. He's like strumming his guitar and ready to go, and I just sort of caught the scene.
He raised, I think, $50,000 last year. But, as charming as the story might seem, I mean, Kay Chaw, this is the president of a university handing the hat around to raise money so his students can attend. How would you characterize this?
I think it's a big red flag that you have university presidents trying to raise money for their students. I mean, I commend him for that effort, don't get me wrong, but it shouldn't have to be the case that we're passing a hat around to help students. That's the job of the state. That's not the job of a university president or the people who come and listen to him play guitar.
Bob, you interviewed some students for this piece. What have you heard from them?
I've been doing these stories for about if I could just say one thing about Rob and his concert, too, was that the brew pub owner matched the first $500, so that was cool, and he was a Lock Haven grad. And Rob has kind of gone around to, local festivals doing these concerts, so it's very well known, the economic stresses that the students face in these small college towns that are seeing all these enrollment declines and higher tuitions. Going to the students, I think that when I write these stories, you get a lot of older readers who say, in my era, I paid my way through college, and if you can't afford college, you shouldn't go, and the state should cut off the funding, and I think that that's, back in the 70s, when a lot of these people went to college, or the 80s, for one thing, the minimum wage was higher, the college costs were lower, and the economy was dramatically different, where you didn't necessarily have to go to college to get a middle-class degree. I think that the union at the public colleges says that it took, you could pay off your college in, 3 years of summer jobs back in the mid-70s, and now it would take 18 years of summer jobs to pay off your college. So these are totally different economics.
Kate Cho, what's the reality for students today?
Well, I think what we've done is we've put students in a no-win situation, because we now have an economy in Pennsylvania, but also across the country, in which some kind of post-secondary credential is pretty much necessary to get a living wage job. And by credential, I don't mean necessarily a bachelor's degree. It could be a certificate that's only 1 year in the making. It could be an associate's degree. But we've created an economy that requires students to do that, and then we've priced them out of getting that credential. So the question on the table is, how are young people and even adults in this economy supposed to function if we require them, if we've created a requirement for them, but we don't provide them with an affordable avenue to get that credential.
It's not just smaller schools. Penn State is dealing with what seems to be a sizable loss of students. Enrollment at 17 of 21 of the Penn State campuses down.
I was stunned when I did the numbers.
Not State College, though.
No, State College. But the only reason why they have done well, that is growing, is that they've gotten out-of-state students to make up the difference. And so that's even stranger because the state does support Penn State. And so they're basically supporting out-of-state students to at least the main campus. But the branch campuses, I mean, there is no question that the enrollment is collapsing. And I think that that's I think that's an eye-opener for most people who think that Penn State is immune immune to these issues.
Is the health of the Penn State system at stake? Kate?
I think that the Penn State system may have expanded in a way that probably wasn't the wisest move. They, you know, those branch campuses have proliferated. And then those branch campuses, many of which used to be sort of commuter campuses, now are residential campuses. And that costs a lot of money to create, you know, to build those dorms. But, you know, essentially what we see here is in the PASHI institutions, at the Penn State system as well, an emphasis, almost a wholly focused emphasis on traditionally aged students. And demographically, we just have shrinking, you know, numbers of 18-year-olds, and we will for some time. And so the real question about sort of the viability of these campuses really, to me, in part, has to do with whether or not they can pivot and begin to make themselves more hospitable to adult students, many of whom do need a post-secondary credential, many of whom maybe already have a year or so of college under their belt, but left college, you know, to raise a family or whatever. You know, our higher ed system in this state, we need to raise the educational attainment of the state writ large. And that means both traditionally aged students, but also adults, you know, adults who need to increase their post-secondary attainment. Mm.
And just, we have about 45 seconds before we head to the break. Just briefly, you know, the, living on campus increases the load for a student. So there are a lot of empty dorm rooms at some of these colleges. Is this a real bottom line issue for the institutions?
I believe so. Yeah, I think they're going to have to tear these dorms down if they don't fill them up. And when I went to Hazleton, empty dorms. When I went to Mansfield, there's like two big dorm complexes that they've scheduled to tear down.
Are you hearing from leaders of these institutions that this is what's going to happen next? These dorms are coming down. They're going to have to reconfigure, or are they right now kind of pretty much staying mum about it?
The Mansfield dorms are definitely coming down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. We are talking for this part of the Radio Times Regional Roundup about the cost of Pennsylvania's state colleges, why it is so high, what happens next, how does this affect students, the debt. The student debt is higher than the national average among students who attend Pennsylvania's in-state institutions. Bob Fernandez is with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Kate Shaw is Executive Director of Research for Action. Stay with us as Radio Times continues. You are listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the next 20 minutes or so, we'll be continuing our conversation on the cost of Pennsylvania state colleges and universities. It's high. Student debt is up. Dorm rooms in some places are shutting down. Some colleges have lost, I think, Bob Fernandez, Mansfield University, more than half of its students. Bob Fernandez is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Kate Shaw, Executive Director of Research for Action. Just so briefly, with Mansfield University, Bob Fernandez, located, I think, in Tioga County,
yes,
not far from New York State, has lost more than half of its students in the last 9 years. What are the primary challenges facing a school like Mansfield?
You know, after the story ran, I sort of sent out this tweet that said, where have the Pennsylvania students gone? Because when you look at you look at all the enrollment losses, either they're not going to college or they're going to private schools or they're going out of state. And it's probably a combination of all three. I think, you know, there's this belief that, you know, young adults, the college students, are reckless with borrowing money. A lot of the students I have talked to, they are not reckless. They are very nervous about borrowing money, and they are doing everything they can to keep their debt down. And I believe that some of them are just going into the workforce or just not going to college or going someplace else. I think this bodes not well for the state's economy. Everybody needs a credential, it seems like now, or skills. Look, the Brookings Institution just came out with a report. It was in the New York Times today, where Philadelphia had the second most innovation job losses in the country. Hmm. And that has to be worse across the state.
You point out in your reporting that two Big Ten schools, the University of Iowa and Purdue, are actually more affordable for their in-state students than Lock Haven is for Pennsylvanians.
Yeah, Lock Haven is one of the more affordable state schools.
There are 14 state-owned schools in Pennsylvania. Is the field simply too crowded? Are there just too many for the market to bear?
I don't think so. No. I think what you have to do is you have to look at the entire sort of ecosystem of public higher education in Pennsylvania. And what you'll see is we have 14 PASHI institutions that are in rural areas. We only have 14 community colleges that are not necessarily geographically close to those institutions. And so what you have is you have really uneven access to public higher education. And one of the things that I think could really help address this problem with enrollment is for the community colleges and the PASHI institutions to co-locate courses on all of those campuses, because you have a disconnect between the two-year sector and the four-year sector. And I wouldn't be a proponent of shutting down college campuses for a couple reasons. One is that oftentimes they're the major employer in a community, and you really have to take that seriously when you think about shutting institutions down. But secondly, for the students that we care about the most, online education doesn't work very well for them. They actually need personal interaction with their faculty and with student, you know, people that provide supports to them. And so I think moving forward, the state really should seriously consider not shutting down some of these institutions, but instead finding ways to bring more students on those campuses by co-locating the community colleges and the four-year institutions, and again, aggressively recruiting adult students.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into the politics of it then. A yearly budget hassle for lawmakers, Bob Hernandez, this issue?
I somewhat disagree with Kate there. It seems to me like there's overcapacity. When you have so many empty dorm rooms, and you have basically multiple competing college systems that are supported by the taxpayers.
Think some should probably go, or at least shrink in size?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. At this point, I mean, that's just my view of it. The numbers just sort of don't support it. You have the Pennsylvania legislators supporting basically competing educational systems. You got the 14, you got more than 20 Penn State campuses. You got the 14 PASHI. You got Temple University, which has some branch campuses. You got the University of Pittsburgh, which has branch campuses. You got Lincoln. And then you got the community colleges. So all these are competing for one another, and I think the legislators, they just sort of throw up their hands and say, they don't try to solve the solution, they're just thinking, this isn't working.
Kate?
So I think there's a couple things. I think Bob's right about the fact that there's competition, and that's really happening for a couple reasons. The first is that Pennsylvania is one of the least centralized states in the union when it comes to how it governs post-secondary education. There's many states that have like one centralized governing board, and what that allows is for the state to be smart and sort of comprehensive in how it approaches how it funds and supports public higher education. We don't have that here.
So is it all over the map then because we don't have this centralized governing body? Is that how you would characterize it?
It's really all over the map. But the other thing that adds to that fact is that we lack an overarching vision for what higher education should be in Pennsylvania. So the State Board of Education is responsible for developing a higher education master plan. The last time they did that was 15 years ago.
And is this something that's not on Governor Wolf's radar?
It doesn't appear to be.
Hmm. Okay.
Right. But so the State Board could actually take the bull by the horns and go ahead and start working on creating a new master plan. And once you have a broad strategic vision, I think some of what Bob is talking about, that competition, might go away a little bit, because at least there'll be a North Star that the legislature and the governor can sort of point towards when they think about how they're going to fund higher education.
So brass tacks funding, does this tend to fall along party lines? I think you alluded to that earlier in the show, Bob Fernandez.
Yes, I think that the Republican lawmakers, they use the argument that we're funding competing colleges. They complain that some of the costs are out of line at these colleges, and they point to maybe construction projects and high costs at the colleges as reasons to not increase taxes to better fund their public colleges. But, you know, in the state's public colleges. But in the end, they're ducking a solution, and they're hurting the students who are then just forced to pay. And so there's also this broader sort of dynamic happening, which is as the states have constricted spending, like Pennsylvania, which I think is a leading edge of this problem, the federal government has opened the spigot to debt. So the state lawmakers have sort of like, you know, we're not going to solve it. We're just going to keep the funding as it is. So none of these institutions close down, so we aren't criticized, and we'll let the federal government make up the difference in higher tuitions that the students have to borrow.
So let's get back to the original premise of the show. You know, if I'm a parent and I'm about to send a kid off to school, we're starting the search. Again, you've got this. There's this tendency to think, I'm a state resident. We're state residents. We'll get a better deal than we would elsewhere. What should parents and their prospective students think? And, of course, we're talking about the younger age group. You know, anybody of any age think when they're considering Pennsylvania schools in terms of what they're going to get out of it as compared to looking across state lines. Kate?
Well, I mean, one thing that students who are in search of a four-year degree should do is to consider starting at a community college. Our community colleges are still some of the most expensive in the nation, unfortunately. But
there are some deals. There are some hidden deals.
There are some deals, and they're still less expensive than even past year institutions, which are our least expensive four-year institutions. So one thing everybody should consider is that pathway. It's difficult sometimes to transfer from two-year institutions to four-year institutions, and so I think you need to really stay on top of that and make sure you're meeting all the requirements of the receiving institution. But that's one way for, you know, state residents to try to keep the cost down.
How do you find out about – we were talking off mic about CCP and the fact that, you know, Philadelphia students, there is a scholars program that helps with tuition. Mm-hmm. Where can students, prospective students, start to begin to look to find these deals that are out there? They want to remain in state.
I think that's a really important question. I don't think there's a centralized place that people can look in Pennsylvania, and that's one of the major problems. So, for example, you just referenced this program at Community College of Philadelphia. My organization has been studying what are called College Promise programs, which are, you know, scholarship programs that typically cover tuition and fees. And we found that Community College of Philadelphia actually has one of these programs. It's called the 50th Anniversary Scholars Program. And it's available to recent graduates of the Philadelphia School District. Unfortunately, over the last few years, they've supported less than 1,000 students.
And is that because people don't know about it?
That's in part because people don't know about it. And so my colleagues went and talked to students in our comprehensive high schools, and they didn't understand that there was such a program out there. And so I think that CCP might be able to do a better job of publicizing this, but also, you know, can we find a way for the school district? Can we find a way maybe for the mayor's office or for advocacy organizations in the city to make it known that those kinds of pathways exist for students? Because I think even in Philadelphia, even though many students qualify for Pell Grants, many students would qualify for this kind of aid, a lot of students coming out of our public high schools still believe that they can't afford college, when in reality, there's oftentimes more aid available to them just because they're coming from really, you know, high poverty homes.
Returning to politics for a moment, Republican State Senator Patrick Brown is co-chair of a bipartisan commission looking into the state of the higher education system. He has said that holding institutions accountable could help. What does he mean by this, Bob Fernandez, holding them accountable?
So I think that Senator Brown is looking for a solution, and I think it's going to be a hard climb for him. And he was clear with me on the phone that I'm not going to tell legislators, and obviously he's talking to his Republican colleagues, what we should fund or how much we should increase. But he needs to be able to go to them and say, okay, we're going to try to increase the funding for the PASHE schools, but for them to get the funding, they have to hit these targets. And he was in some of the things he mentioned was retention, graduation rates, student diversity, and so he could then sort of argue to those reluctant Republicans, hey, they're trying. We're going to get our money's worth, and it's not going to go into a new building.
Kate, does this model tend to work well?
It really depends. So what? Bob is describing is something called outcomes-based funding or student-centered funding, and it exists in, I think, over 30 states now in the country, and essentially it is an accountability policy. And what it does is it takes some of the funding that a state would provide to an institution and provide it on the provision that the state, that the institution improve graduation rates or retention rates, those kinds of things. And so, you know, these programs are complicated. The devil's in the details. It can work. But I think one of the things we need to remember is that it's not a level playing field. It's not as though, you know, a little teeny institution in a rural area of Pennsylvania has the same kind of capacity that, say, a Westchester University would have.
Which is one of the colleges that's doing well, one of the institutions that's doing well.
Absolutely. And so part of what this brings up for me is this larger question of whether or not we can create a rational way of distributing dollars to higher ed institutions in the same way that we've tried to do in K-12. So in K-12, we have a baseline amount of funding per student, and then if a student is special ed or an English learner, or it comes from a high-poverty household, the school district gets more money for those students because those students require more. We don't do that in higher ed. I don't know why we don't. But I think in the state of Pennsylvania, that's where you would have to start. You would have to try to level the playing field to make sure that the institutions that are serving the students that need the most help actually get more money per student. So I think it's this larger question about how do we fund our higher ed institutions to get the results that we need to support our state economy? Because at the end of the day, higher education is the engine of the state economy, and we're ignoring it as such.
Outcomes-based funding would probably not work, at least at this point, with an institution like Cheney University. The situation has been dire in recent years, although there has been some good news recently for Cheney because its academic accreditation has been affirmed by the Middle States Commission on Higher Education. But Bob Fernandez, just 618 students on the Cheney campus this fall, they've got to work to a place where they can get to working on outcomes-based funding, correct?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on Cheney. Mm-hmm. I sort of did not focus on them because you could always point to the worst performer or those who are in the most disastrous situation. So I think you almost need a special package of rescue for Cheney, and I think that's what they're trying to do. And I did read from Susan Snyder's story that they're going to try to forgive the $40 million in debt and move on. I think it's the other schools. I mean, like Mansfield, Edinburgh, and say the Hazleton Penn State campus. I mean, you got to find a reason for these to exist. I think Mansfield, some of these are self-inflicted wounds where they went into some sort of different pricing models. They tried to be elite schools or somewhat elite schools, and so there needs to be a reality check, I think, on them.
Keisha, how do you see this playing out over the next 5 years in Harrisburg regarding schools like – and I'm just asking you to look into the crystal ball, nothing definitive, but with something like Mansfield or Lock Haven and et cetera.
I don't know what Harrisburg is going to do. I do know that there are lots of states that have done innovative things to try to address these questions. It's not as though Pennsylvania is unique. I think Pennsylvania is an outlier in that our enrollment drops are among the most severe in the country. but other states are dealing with this as well. And so, for example, in the state of Connecticut, they've consolidated their community college system. They've created one community college with multiple campuses. And in doing so, what they're trying to do is to reduce administrative costs, centralize the administrative costs in one place, and in that way, you know, try to keep those campuses viable, but at the same time, deal with the fact that the, you know, the cost of keeping them afloat has gotten untenable.
So there's that centralized governing body concept again. And I guess my question is there any sense that in the legislature that this is something that might be considered seriously?
You know, I doubt it. Pennsylvania is, not to be negative again.
Speak the truth, Bob.
Pennsylvania, you know, it's a lot of home rule. It's a Commonwealth state. Every town has it likes to be its own entity. Every university wants to be its own entity, and that's the way the system has been built. And it would be a lot to sort of centralize it. I'm not saying it doesn't need to be, but there needs to be a political consensus to do this. And I have to say that there's not a lot of time here to figure this out because, I mean, it's my understanding that in 2025 is when there's going to be a big decline in high school graduates.
Really?
Because when at the time of the Great Recession was when young couples weren't having children and weren't getting married and households weren't forming. So you have this sort of demographic it's not a bubble. It's the opposite of a bubble.
Contraction
coming through the system. So if you see this decline in enrollment in the last decade, I think there's going to be a few years of stabilization, and then there's going to be a decline again, a big one, in high school graduates.
All right. Well, we'll be following this story. Thank you so much for joining us. Bob Fernandez, reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Thank you, Mary.
Kate Shaw, executive director of Research for Action, a nonprofit educational research organization in Philadelphia. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
And just ahead on Radio Times, we're going to learn about the falling number of trees in Philadelphia over the last decade or so and the city's plan to add more green to the cityscape. Important stuff. Stay with us. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome back to Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Philadelphia is home to over 17,000 acres of trees. And while that might seem like a lot, the reality is Philly has lost close to 1,100 acres of its tree canopy over the last decade, equivalent to about 1,000 football fields. It's sobering news because trees do so much for us. They help to mitigate the effects of climate change by removing carbon dioxide from the air. They have a cooling effect during summer. Research shows that the presence of trees can reduce crime, and the list goes on. So the city is launching a concerted effort to increase its tree canopy. It's called the 10-Year Urban Forest Plan. And here to tell us more about it is Catherine Ott-Lovell, Commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Parks and Recreation. Welcome back, Catherine.
Thank you.
And Erica Smith-Fitchman is Philly's Community Forestry Manager. So nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
So Philadelphia's tree canopy covers about 20% of the city. When we talk about the canopy, what are we referring to? Erica?
Sure. The tree canopy is the layer of leaves and branches that you would see if you were looking at the city from above.
The city commissioned the University of Vermont to do an assessment, which found that from 2008 to 2018, Philly did gain some canopy acreage, but lost more. So there was a net loss of over 1,000 acres of tree canopy. So, Catherine, researchers used aerial imagery. How did they capture this picture?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So it's called LIDAR, and they actually fly an airplane. so we have this incredible data set that the University of Vermont then analyzes and are able to determine exactly what that tree canopy is using for our our process was using what they could see, trees that were 8 feet and taller.
What does the report show us? Were some neighborhoods hit harder than others by tree loss?
They were, yeah. So the report definitely shows us a loss, but we know that we have a very dynamic urban forest, so that you know, tree loss is an event. It can happen in a day, for example, a bad ice storm.
The entire tree could go in a bad ice
correct,
storm.
Correct, yep. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, so but what we really know is that the tree planting is really, it's a process, and it takes, you know, many, many years of dedicated, smart, thoughtful planning. So we experience this loss, overall loss, net loss, as you say, and what we're really looking forward to with our new strategic plan, the first ever for the city of Philadelphia, is a very collaborative effort across government agencies, nonprofit groups, universities, institutions, the corporate community, to reverse that trend.
You want to get the canopy from 20% to 30%.
Right. Yeah. 30% in every neighborhood has been our goal.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's all about equity of tree canopy cover, trying to make sure that the people who need the canopy most, that have the highest heat, for example, in their neighborhoods, are getting that tree canopy coverage the same as people in neighborhoods that already have 30% or more. And we do have neighborhoods that are quite high in some areas of the neighborhood.
We did do a show, devoted part of a show, Erica, not too long ago to heat islands within the city, you know, focusing on neighborhoods which suffer much higher temperatures in the summer than others. Hunting Park can be 10, 15, even 20 degrees hotter than other areas of the city. There's asphalt, black roofs, fewer green spaces. Is this a particularly difficult challenge, though, to construct an urban forest in some of these neighborhoods because they are so densely packed?
It is. You know, the city of Philadelphia is broken up into so many small pieces that are owned by so many different people. And one of the things we found with the report is that the residential area of the city lost the most tree canopy. And that means that the decisions of every single person, what they decide to do with their trees and their property, is making a collective impact on the city. So that's why we want to make sure that we have a really comprehensive public engagement piece to our strategic plan so that we are both educating but also hearing from people what are the challenges that they have to planting trees in their neighborhoods, whether it's street trees or yard trees. And then, like Catherine said, incorporating collaboration from all the other city agencies that impact the urban forest, institutions, even place-based organizations like cemeteries and large places like the Schuylkill Center, the Morris Arboretum.
So are you talking about holding informational hearings, say, in specific neighborhoods?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've had a program over the last 8 or so years called Tree Philly, which has been a wonderful way to not just engage residents in planting trees on their own property, but first and foremost, it's an educational process. I grew up in the city, a fourth-generation Philadelphian. I live in the city now. I'm raising my family here. Before I started in this job, I knew very little about trees, you know, and their impact on our city and their impact on my home and my family. And so first and foremost, we want this process to be a way that we can engage and educate Philadelphians about the importance of trees for many of the reasons you mentioned. This is a social equity issue. You know, this is not just environmental. This is not, you know, when I thought about trees prior to this job, I thought, oh, well, you know, it's important for the environment. This is important for public health. This is important for economic and community development. And it's that that message that we want to make sure is getting out there to Philadelphians.
Well, when you were growing up as a fourth generation Philadelphian, what do you recall of growing up? Trees, the attitude toward trees in your family?
Well,
did you live a row home,
yes,
larger home?
Now, my mother just passed away last week, but we used my mom as, you know, in our sort of test case conversations at Parks and Rec. And I said, how do we convince Mrs. Ott that she should get a street tree? And here's why she hates street trees. She hates them because, you know, that things fall and she has to clean it up. She hates it because she thinks it's going to break up her utility pipe. She hates it because she thinks it's going to break up her sidewalk and she's going to get sued. So how do we bust those myths?
Are they myths?
They're myths. They're absolutely myths. They might not have been myths 50 years ago, 100 years ago, when the city was not planting the right trees, but we've gotten so smart. We've gotten so strategic. We have the right people like Erica, an incredible team of tree experts and arborists who know exactly what trees to plant now. So it really is a matter of busting those myths and helping people realize that the benefits to trees far outweigh any potential risks that there would be for homeowners.
Erica, street tree versus yard tree. What's the difference?
Well, technically, a street tree is planted in the right-of-way, along the sidewalk, like a stop sign or a street light, and a yard tree is on private property. We have different types of trees we can plant in these different areas. Street trees are under a lot of stress. Compaction, drought.
Compaction meaning what? They're stuck in concrete and it's hard for them to thrive.
Yeah, they don't have very much space to grow. When we plant trees, we try to give them as much space as we can for public safety, within public safety limits. But they have limited space. They have limited water. They have animals that may go to the bathroom on them. They have salt. They have all sorts of impacts. And so there's a big difference between planting trees in the street and in your yard. And we always choose the right tree for the right place. That's kind of a big thing in the arboriculture world. So like Catherine said, we have a team of certified arborists that make decisions about street trees. And then when we do our yard tree giveaways, we have a certain list of trees that we know are good for people's yards in Philadelphia.
So what do you like for yards, just briefly, and what do you like for street trees?
What types of trees?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, for street trees, we're looking at trees that are really strong and are disease resistant. And so we look at our different elm species. We look at different maple species. And we also have a lot of different trees we have to plant for under wires. So we have red buds. We have tree lilacs. We have hornbeams, which is a not as popular, but beautiful tree.
How about yard trees?
For yard trees, we like to provide people with native trees that are going to need a little bit more space to grow and a little bit more care. Fruit trees as well. People really
love
the other fruit trees. And people are often looking for beauty for their yards as well. They want their tree to do something a little more. So the yard tree, the fruit trees and the flowering trees are really popular. And so we're also trying to choose trees that are going to survive in a changing climate. We know what's going to happen here in Philadelphia. It's going to get hotter and wetter. So we're starting to work with our nursery to grow trees that are native to more southern areas so that we can have a yard tree stock that is going to survive in the future.
Catherine Ott-Lovell, Erica had mentioned tree giveaways. So if a Philadelphian says, well, I'd like to put something in my backyard, is there also advice to go along with that? Somebody who might come out to the yard and say, well, I'd put it over here as opposed to over in this corner because it will do better.
Yeah. So we actually do so many of our tree giveaways now through community organizations. We have a great community yard grant program where we actually offer nonprofit organizations a grant to host and support tree planting in their community and to give away the trees for us. And there's a huge educational process that happens with those community groups. So it's less about, you know, us, you know, the city going to people's homes and more about really engaging people at a community grassroots level. And then we also work closely with PHS and their Tree Tenders program. We work with other nonprofit organizations that are engaging residents in communities around tree care, in addition to educating those individual homeowners that would like to have a tree.
How should people treat or even care for trees in their neighborhood? We're talking not only about the yard trees, but the street trees. Do you want people to fully participate if we're in a drought? Carry out a bucket of water and, you know, I mean, Erica, because sometimes, you know, if I don't know what I'm doing, I might actually do more harm than good.
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. We definitely, in terms of street trees, we definitely want people to participate. We want them to weed around the bottom of their tree. We want them to pick up the trash that accumulates there. We want them to water when it is dry out, but you're right, people might not know exactly the right way to do it. When you water a tree, you want to water it once a week, a long, deep watering. So for a tree that's along the street, that's about 30 gallons and a slow trickle. So we often recommend a tree watering bag. That's a slow release watering bag. Or if you don't want to spring for that, you can get a 5-gallon bucket, punch a hole in it, fill it up a couple times, and there you go.
You can probably develop a relationship. I know I love plants, so I kind of already have that going with green things, but I'm imagining if you're taking care of a tree, you can develop a relationship with that tree, start to become concerned about it, or you observe, obviously, the change of seasons, wildlife, and et cetera.
Absolutely. We also want to make sure that people don't remove trees without talking with us first.
Oh, do you find that?
Yes.
In street trees?
Sure. Yes. You know, people might, see a tree that they think is at the end of its life and they don't want it to, fall or impact someone's safety or fall in their car or fall in their home.
Yeah.
Right. Because a street tree might not be on your property, but it could be falling in the direction of your home. And so people, we find, sometimes take it upon themselves to bring somebody out to take down that tree. And it's not necessarily at the end of its life. And so we encourage them to first reach out to us so that we can, send an arborist out to make sure that the tree is at the end of its life.
Free of charge.
Correct. Yeah. And then we can also recommend if we're not able, if the tree is, at the end of its life and we're not able to take that tree down, we can recommend some contractors to do it, in a more expedited way. But we definitely don't want people out there, rogue tree removals is not.
Or even cutting branches if you're not sure what
you're
doing.
If you don't know what you're doing, you absolutely should not be pruning trees. Yeah.
So Catherine, a tree summit was held last week in Philadelphia. Let's talk about what happens next in this process as part of the plan to increase the canopy. In the immediate future, what is going to happen?
Well, we did have about 150 people at the Tree Summit. They represented organizations all over the city and beyond, all over the region. So this is definitely a collaborative effort that the city, through Parks and Recreation and the Office of Sustainability, are leading. And then we have a really robust planning process that'll take place that Erica can talk a little bit more about.
Sure. Yeah, we have a project team that has been working to draft a request for proposal because we want a consultant team to put together a plan. We're looking for a team that has the subject matter expertise, knows arboriculture, but also knows the city of Philadelphia and can do a really comprehensive public engagement strategy. So we're looking for a team of consultants to do that. We heard from the folks at the Tree Summit who represented people from all over the city and the region and even nationally, the U.S. Forest Service, for example.
So is there funding coming from these various groups to help make this help this initiative go forward?
Right. For the planning process, we have funding from the William Penn Foundation, TD Bank, and the Pennsylvania Urban and Community Forestry Council, Tree Pennsylvania, which is from the state. So we have a number of funds for the planning process itself. And then implementation, we're going to be looking at what is recommended in the plan. And then we have a number of sources already identified for looking at funding for that.
And because it can take a while to grow a tree, when do you anticipate having the 30% canopy coverage? Is our target?
So much of that depends on the resources that we're able to get, towards the initiative. It's not free, we would love to think that, tree planting is just Mother Nature. But the truth is that to be strategic about it, and really, again, I can't stress enough that we're looking at this from an equity lens. And we're looking at neighborhoods that are impacted, as you said, with heat. And how can we really be much more strategic than we ever have in identifying those neighborhoods and going to those neighborhoods first? Whereas in some communities, there might be resources that as a homeowner, I can afford to plant or remove my tree. In other communities, there may not be those resources. So much of, and those are, that's our lowest canopy areas, are in some communities where people might not be able to afford, privately what we would like them to do. So
like Hunting Park.
Correct. Yeah. So it's really about how quickly can we, generate the interest and the resources necessary to make this happen.
And in 10 seconds, the benefits of this increased greenery, again, are
a more vibrant city, a healthier city, and healthier people who live in it.
Well, we're up against the clock, but just wanted to say thank you so much for joining us. Can't wait to see what happens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Ott Lovell is Commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Parks and Recreation, and Erica Smith-Fitchman is Philadelphia's Community Forestry Manager. And as always, check us out on social media. Let us know what you think. It's all at WHYY.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.